fifth case, Mosley versus the City of Chicago.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Sean Mulroney.
Excuse me.
Yes, Mulroney, and I represent Jovan Mosley. Thanks for the opportunity to argue this before you. It's be my third time here. The first time was a year out of law school back in '88. I did this twice. But
boy, you look good.
Thank you, Your Honor. Cutting to what I think this is about today, this is a Brady case. And with respect to the three-part test as set forth by Brady and his progeny, this case is really coming down to that third prong.
So is it a Brady case, though? I mean, this court has wondered, at least in print, whether Brady is the right vehicle for somebody who has actually enjoyed a due process right to a trial and at the trial has been acquitted, which, of course, it's one of the reasons that the trials are part of due process. That's the gold standard, actually. So the problem here wasn't a trial problem, was it?
No, Your Honors, you're exactly correct. And as I'm sure you're aware, this court has left the door slightly ajar with respect to your decisions in the Carvajal and the Bielanski cases.
In the sense that we keep saying we're not going to decide it because there was another reason that would support more or less the same outcome in those cases.
Well, that's correct. In the Carvajal case, it was found that there was an issue regarding photographs and that those photographs would not have had an impact on any of the process. And so that a decision, while leaving the door open, was there was nothing made with respect to whether or not the Brady, it left the door slightly ajar. And with respect to the Bielanski case, I think the finding was that the proceeding would not have been shortened by the revelation of the evidence in question. So,
but you know, it seems to me, kind of cutting through all the rhetoric of Brady or other things, the real problem here is that Mr. Mosley languishes in jail for 5 years and change, maybe because his lawyer is agreeing to too many extensions of time and failing to insist on a speedy trial right. But I'm having trouble linking that length of time with the evidence that you're focusing on. Even if Brady does also apply to some very narrow set of cases where the failure to disclose means the difference between a prosecutor going forward or not. But I'm not sure if it does. But even if it did, how does this evidence have that kind of a profound impact?
Well, to answer that question, Your Honor, I guess I need to take it in a couple of steps. And one of them is looking at the United States Supreme Court of Kyles versus Whiteley, which says that disclosure must be looked at in not in a case-by-case basis, but in its entirety. The Bagley court said that the reviewing court may consider any adverse effect the prosecutor's failure to respond may have had on the preparation or presentation of the defendant's case.
But we do know that these prosecutors went forward even though they were already apparently not going to use Reed, because they don't use Reed.
Well, that enlightened decision happened on the eve of trial.
Well,
and so what we have is the issue, of course, with...
But they went forward with the trial. They could have dropped the charges that day if they'd wanted to.
Well, and apparently at trial they found out that Anton Williams, testified that he could not identify Jovan Mosley as having participated. And I think we can suppose, based on the ABA guidelines and so forth, that a prosecutor having knowledge that both of his eyewitnesses, neither of which could testify at trial, would be poorly served by pushing forward with that trial.
Can I... I'd like to ask you this. You've not really, in the briefs, directly answered a very important argument in this case. Mr. Mosley was charged and tried under an accountability theory. It doesn't matter whether he struck a blow. So why would it be material whether Williams said he didn't see what Mosley did versus that he affirmatively saw that he didn't strike a blow?
Well, in essence, what you're putting weight on the fact that what Williams said, what the record reflects is that Williams said that he could not identify Mosley as doing anything. and that he told the police officers that. And what it also shows is that Reed, the only other witness to be able to identify Mulley, was too intoxicated to have any independent recollection. So what you have is nobody that can identify Mosley as having done anything. So there can't be accountability if there's no action.
He's there with the group.
So is Reed. And he wasn't charged either.
It depends on the role. On accountability theory cases, and I'm just speaking in general terms, not about Mr. Mosley's case in particular, but sometimes a person is standing there keeping an eye out to see if the police are coming up, and he's not actually raining blows on someone, but he's playing a role. Or sometimes somebody's the one who provided the ride or the idea, and he's, again, not actually physically carrying it out. So there are a lot of things that happen in accountability cases that don't necessarily depend on the kind of active participation that we'll assume neither Williams nor Reed was in a position to support. In fact, as I remember, Mr. Mosley said that he'd never seen Reed anything but intoxicated. So we know Reed's unreliable. I was concerned about that too. What do we make of this?
Well, Mosley's testimony was that he stayed by the porch and that he was, in effect, trying to block the view from the young woman who was there from seeing this. And he also testified that he did not see, once the bat came out, he left.
Williams, the eyewitness, said repeatedly over the years to the police and others that Mosley was part of the group of young men who rushed the victim. And, you know, it was at trial, in response to a leading question, that he indicated that he told the police that Mosley was out there, but had not done anything.
You're correct, Your Honor. And then with respect to the testimony you're referring to, that's his deposition under, extensive examination by counsel and not contemporaneous to the actual action itself. At the time of the trial, he said that Mosley was there and didn't do anything. Reed was there and didn't do anything. Was there and didn't do anything.
You see, my problem, and I've really tried to think about this a lot, is that even if we assume that Williams told the police that Mosley didn't strike a blow, that would not have destroyed the prosecution's case. There was still probable cause to charge him and try him. You've got the eyewitness saying that he rushed the victim with everyone else.
Well, with respect to the eyewitness, there was a statement contained in Treadwell, who was one of the defendants who was ultimately convicted, that said Mosley did that. He also testified that he was told what to say by the defendant detectives. Regarding the testimony of Williams and Reed, they are both, Reed, hearsay evidence has no independent recollection, and Williams has said that he didn't see him do anything. In fact, he was there, but he did not see him do anything, and he told the police officers that. What we have is a withholding of that information that could have allowed a potential investigation by defendants and by the defense. Now, if the defense had had that opportunity, perhaps they would have done something else. Maybe they would have...
In that regard, did Mr. Mosley's attorney not have opportunity to speak to Mr. Reed and Mr. Williams?
They did have the opportunity. However, Your Honor, the thing that's so troubling with this case is that everything related to the Williams testimony was contained in there were no records. They didn't exist for any of that stuff. What we do have is a lineup report, which was authored 15 months after the actual lineup, while Detective Hill was reassigned to financial crimes, and he testified that he did without the benefit of notes.
But he did say that in the report, doesn't he? He says something like, "I'm writing this down 15 months later because I've just discovered that it was never recorded."
And
so he's not trying to cover it up or anything.
That's correct. But what the findings of that same lineup report say is that an investigation indicated that Jovan Mosley participated in the attack. And that statement in itself is incredibly misleading, because that's not what Williams said. That was something that was done 15 months later.
Mr. Maroney, wasn't that report turned over to defense counsel?
That was indeed turned over, well after the...
Cross-examination during the trial indicate he was aware of all that. That is the defense counsel.
At the trial, Williams stated that Mosley was there and did not participate in the attack, and he had told the police officer that. None of that information was contained in that report. Therefore, that report was misleading, and that critical information of his statement that he was there and did not do anything, which should have appeared in that report, wasn't there. That misleading report precluded a defense attorney from following that line of attack.
Well, that wouldn't preclude him from talking directly to Mr. Reed or Mr. Williams.
No, it happened. But what it did, Your Honor, is it hid the first yellow brick on the yellow brick road down that path of truth. I see that I've been zapped here. Is there any other questions?
No, thank you.
I hope to reserve some rebuttal, but this was very engaging.
I'll cut you off, Mr. Maroney. You use your time, but... I'll allow some time for rebuttal, even though you have used up your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Hornstra?
May it please the Court. It should be clear from the record that Mr. Mosley was rightly suspected in this chilling crime. As regards the evidence of his participation, as both Judge Wood and Judge Rovner rightly put out, under the prosecution's theory, it wasn't necessary that there be evidence that Mosley struck a blow. And it's important to keep in mind that, of course, Mr. Reed and Mr. Williams, Anton Williams, weren't the only witnesses in this case. One of the neighbors, Ronald Barnes, recounted that there were four men standing around Mr. Thomas when he was beaten. Another witness said it was so loud that it sounded like gunshots. There were four men standing around him while Mr. Thomas pleaded for his life and tried to escape. So it was certainly reasonable for the detectives to investigate Mr. Mosley and for the prosecution to pursue him as a suspect.
So on the Brady, as I understand the theory that the plaintiffs are pursuing, what would have to be shown is something that isn't a malicious prosecution theory, because we have that state law claim, and that we all know turns on probable cause. So not a malicious prosecution theory, but something that would have caused the prosecutors to drop this case before the moment of trial. Because if it's anything other than that, there is a trial. The flaws in the state's case against Mr. Mosley come out at the trial, and in fact the jury acquits him. So there's this theory that there's somehow something that's beyond malicious prosecution, but not quite the trial.
That seems to be the theory. I think that there, Mr. Mosley's counsel has, I think, seized on some of the dicta in Carvajal and Bielanski that talks about the possibility. Of course, the court hasn't endorsed that possibility of a Brady claim for an acquitted defendant, but hasn't ruled it out because it didn't need to. Something that I think should be kept in mind.
That the decision to go to trial would have been materially affected by the
right.
Disclosure of the evidence. And the evidence here, I guess, is the flaws in the lineup report, the fact that Williams may not have really seen anything or saw that Mr. Mosley wasn't doing things. Actually, we have these verbal formulations. Did he not know, or did he know that Mosley wasn't there?
Right. And then, of course, the fact of Reed's intoxication. And none of the information, basically these are limitations on the witness testimony that Williams or Reed could offer. And Mr. Mosley wasn't deprived of the ability to use any of that evidence at trial. Certainly, this is why this just really shouldn't be seen as a
but
Brady claim.
But a pretrial, if he had had all of this evidence in his hands, could he have gone to the state prosecutor, the assistant state's attorney, and said, look, you've got nothing on me. I should be like Reed.
Absolutely. There was, if the prosecution's case was as weak as Mr. Mosley claims it is, in hindsight after his acquittal, it was absolutely, any reasonably diligent defense attorney could have gone and pressed for a speedy trial. They would have had to try it. He could have talked to the state's attorney about reducing the charges. I understand the state's attorney wasn't willing to do that. I think what the length of time his detention, reflects, unfortunately, some systemic problems, with court loads and both prosecutors and public defenders' caseloads. But I think also it reflects a reasonable concern on the part of his defense attorneys that under the accountability theory, there was enough to convict him. And his public defenders all said that they thought delay was in his best interest.
How could they have thought that? I mean, I don't get that, actually.
I think there were several considerations. The fact that there were four defendants in these types of cases, I understand nobody really wants to go first. One of the witnesses, Jory Garth, was, I think, 14 at the time. Her father was a police officer. The defense attorneys thought they might be able to get more favorable testimony from her when she was older and not under the control of her father. That was one of the things one of the public defenders thought. People think, memories might fade in this type of a case. So there were a number of considerations going into it, but I think there was a legitimate concern that he'd be convicted. And for a lot of people, if you're in Cook County Jail, you're closer to your family. If you get convicted, you get sent some off someplace else. You get credit for time served. So there's no need to speed it up unless you know you're going to get acquitted. And again, if the evidence was as weak as Mr. Mosley now suggests it is, his attorney certainly could have pressed for trial. And there was nothing that the police officers did that kept them from understanding that Anton Williams's account was consistent. Again, there's some different formulations, but he testified at the grand jury. I didn't see him hit him. There was no confusion about what he could testify to at trial. And as for Gregory Reed, he, again, didn't testify at trial. If anybody was expecting him to be some kind of star witness, everybody involved in this, I think, considered him a bit of a clown, and he was always drunk. Certainly that was more known to the defendants in these cases than it was to the police officers who were his friends. So there was just, Mosley himself said, Reed's a drunk. I've never seen him when he wasn't drunk. And so if his defense attorneys wanted to investigate that to press for trial, that they certainly could have. So any delay is not attributable to the police officers. I think one point that maybe bears clarification in the notion of a Brady claim for an acquitted defendant, the language in Carvajal and Bielanski does, I think, adopt as a materiality standard whether the decision to go to trial would have been changed if the disclosure had been made. And, of course, that was an alternative materiality standard to the one the Supreme Court has adopted, because the reasonable probability of a different verdict won't work. And I really read those cases as talking about that as the standard of the evidence you would have to show you were denied a fair trial. But no case has ever recognized the notion of a Brady claim based on something other than an unfair trial itself. And the district court in this case, I think, was confused a little bit by that language and actually thought that if Mr. Mosley could show that basically the course of the prosecution would have been altered by an earlier disclosure, he could have sought recovery for his entire pretrial detention. And I think it bears some clarification that a real Brady claim has to be premised on the denial of a fair trial and not, this sort of garden variety malicious prosecution. Because, of course, this court has foreclosed those claims under the due process clause, and divorcing what you would call a Brady violation from the context of trial would really just invite plaintiffs to try to evade that rule by trying to characterize something as a Brady claim. Because the evidence simply does not show the suppression of any material evidence, and the claims are not founded on any legal basis, we would ask that the district court summary judgment be affirmed.
Thank you, Ms. Hornstra. Ms. Maroney, you may have an additional minute or so if you need it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess I'd like to address just a couple of things. And one is that this court in the Bielanski found that favorable evidence is material if there's a reasonable probability or possibility that the evidence had been disclosed, that the result of the proceeding, not the trial, the proceeding, would have been different. And that follows directly in line with U.S. versus Bagley. It also found that the decision to go to trial would have been altered. Counsel's statement that there was another witness, Ronald Barnes.
Why is dropping the charges better than an acquittal? I mean, an acquittal it gives full double jeopardy protection against any further proceedings. I mean, it seems to me your theory is that it would have been better for charges simply to have been dropped.
Before
jeopardy attached.
Well, our theory is that had this information been made available and not withheld, that competent defense counsel would have pursued that angle and therefore would have either moved for a dismissal, would have moved to sever the trial, would have moved to have this trial, a speedy trial act, move this to have it expedited, would have perhaps done for time served. He was there for 5 years and 8 months. There's a lot of alternatives, all of which would have gone into the thought process of the trial strategy of defense. And without those two things, that cannot be. The one last thing is, again, with Ronald Barnes there and four other defendants, he noticed four people. Well, Reed was there, too. So there were four people there. If there's nothing else, I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.